Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Ethan Elkind. Scientists estimate that over 8 million tons of plastic enter the world's oceans each year, wreaking havoc on marine life, who become trapped in abandoned fishing nets or mistake plastic bags for food. Much of it breaks down into irretrievable tiny particles. And now some of this plastic, it's finding its way back into our food system, not as packaging, but inside our food and water. How can we stop the onslaught of plastic into our oceans? San Francisco has passed some of the most aggressive legislation in the country to limit single-use plastics. It was the first city to ban plastic bags back in 2007, and just recently, effective July 1st, last week, it banned plastic straws and other single-use items. But clearly, there's more that needs to be done. So joining us in the studio tonight to talk about the problem of plastic pollution is Debbie Raphael, director of San Francisco's Department of the Environment. Welcome, Debbie.
Thank you, Ethan.
And on the phone tonight, joining us is Rachel Kosha, Plastic Pollution Manager for the Surf Rider Foundation. Welcome, Rachel.
Hi, Ethan. Thanks for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Great. And we invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation. In about 20 minutes, we'll open the phone lines. And the number to dial toll-free is 1-866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. But you can also email us in the meantime at cityvisions@kalw.org or follow us on Twitter at cityvisionskalw. Well, Rachel, let me start with you. Can you describe the problem for us? Exactly how much plastic do scientists estimate is in the ocean, and where does it come from?
Sure, yeah, that's a heavy question. But, I mean, as you mentioned, there is an estimated, and lots of these are estimates because, to be honest, when plastic breaks down into those smaller particles that we call microplastics, it's difficult to really tell how big this problem or how small of a on that smaller scale it's really becoming. But there is the 8 to 9 million tons of plastic that is estimated to enter our ocean, and that's every single year, and that is just from land-based sources, so things like landfill, litter, and other leakage points throughout the waste management system. We also have water-based sources, which is fishing gear primarily. So, I mean, it's coming from all different places, but, you know, basically it comes down to us. We're using the plastic. You can't go through a normal day without encountering, and it's those single-use plastics, too, that really get you. Those are the ones that you use for a few minutes, and they're going to outlive you in the end. So that's really sort of where the problem is stemming from, is that useless plastic that we have built up that need for, and just sort of has taken over our natural environment.
And you mentioned that some of this problem is fishing gear. Do you have an estimate as to what percentage of the plastic is from fishing versus those land-based sources that you mentioned?
Yeah, so about 80% does come from the land-based sources. So that's going to be things like we saw direct litter, and I'm sure we all experienced that over the long 4th of July weekend. I know I saw plenty of it, the spillover from landfills and other leakage areas that happened throughout that waste management process.
And so what's a typical path for some of this litter to end up in the ocean? Is it the rains drive it into the drains, which carry it out to the bay or other waterways? Is that typically how it arrives in the ocean?
Yeah, so that actually is a really important point. You don't have to live next to the ocean to contribute to the problem of ocean plastic. All waterways lead to the ocean, so if you're next to a stream, even a creek that's leading into a larger pond, lake, that eventually is getting to the ocean, those bits of plastic that you see on the side of the road, those overfilled trash bins that you see at your local parks, all of that does eventually blow into the waterways, which lead to the ocean. So, you know, there's not a necessarily traditional path that any piece of plastic might take, but it's important to realize that we can contribute to that, whether we're directly dumping it into the ocean or not.
And are all these plastics equal in terms of how they sort of behave and perform in the ocean? What exactly does a plastic pollution consist of, if this is not a monolithic plastic problem?
Yeah, I mean, we try to determine what, and it's difficult too, like I mentioned, once these plastics do break down to a microplastic level, to try and determine, okay, what was this originally? Where did this come from? What product was this a part of? That becomes very difficult to tell when we're talking about true ocean plastic. However, if we look at beach cleanups, that's where we can get a little bit better sense of, you know, what's consisting the majority of that pollution. And actually, Five Gyres, in partnership with a bunch of other organizations, including Surfrider, tried to figure out, you know, what are those key items? And so what we found was it's a lot of, again, those single use. So the top 20 plastic products are all, for the most part, single use. We've got food wrappers, bottle caps, beverage bottles, those straws and stirrers, bags, utensils, cigarette butts. There's even things like balloons and six-pack holders and diapers that end up in this top 20 list. So it is important to realize that, you know, most of those top polluters, at least that we can see from the cleanup perspective, are those products and those things that all of us are using on a daily basis. It's not the medical equipment and the other things, the practical uses of plastic.
And where exactly in the ocean is this plastic collecting? I mean, is it just sort of spread evenly, or are there certain places where we see more of it collecting?
So, yeah, I mean, traditionally we've turned to the gyres to find the largest concentration of ocean plastic. So what gyres are the large, there's five major gyres in the ocean, and they basically are that accumulation of currents that lead to a single spot and become this sort of swirling mass of water. And as you can imagine, plastic being buoyant, especially those really large pieces, can float all the way to a gyre, and that's where they really do begin to break down through the currents, through the sun and the wave action, into those microplastics. And so you could be sitting on top of a gyre and not even realize it's there, because the plastic has become so small and sunk down into the water column that it's really like a plastic soup at that point. And so, yeah, it is really tricky to track these plastics exactly, because we've found them on, you know, the deepest part of the ocean to the tallest part of a mountain to a remote island where no one has lived for, you know, hundreds of years. So, you know, it's tough to say, but we do see those gyres being sort of a collection point for a lot of that.
And you mentioned 8 to 9 million tons a year, but I'm curious about the timeline. When did this become really severe? Has this always been, you know, with us since plastics were invented or ubiquitous on the market? I mean, I have a colleague who grew up in the 1950s on Midway Island. His father was in the Navy. And when he went back just a few years ago, the beaches were just covered, where that was not his memory as a child in the 50s. So can you give us a sense of kind of when this really became a bad problem for the world?
I mean, I personally don't know that answer, but I will say that plastic production continues to be on the rise. So even when, now that we've identified this major concern, and, you know, even the plastic industry cannot deny the problem, but we still continue to see production increasing. We see, you know, more cracking facilities where they produce the plastic popping up. And so, you know, now we know this is an issue, but the problem is that we're still continuing to produce at an increased rate. And I'm sure you've heard the statistic that by the year 2050, there will be more plastic in the ocean than fish, and that is by weight. So that's going to be, you know, plastic is pretty light. So by number, you know, you're going to be swimming through plastic basically at that point. So, you know, I don't know exactly when it became this as large of a concern as it is today, but I do know that it's time that we, you know, turn it around and stop using plastic at this incredible rate.
Yeah, no, that's a pretty shocking projection, and just the data that you have also. Well, let's bring this back more locally here. And Debbie Raphael, as I mentioned at the opening of the show, is the director of San Francisco's Department of the Environment. So, Debbie, can you explain to listeners, you know, what percentage of the garbage that's entering San Francisco Bay is coming from plastic? Like, how big of a problem is this just within the bay here?
Yeah, those were pretty daunting statistics that Rachel shared with us, and just the image of swimming through a soup of plastic should motivate all of us to figure out how to lead a plastic-free existence. Well, when we did a litter survey, we found that almost two-thirds of the litter that was collected either at beach cleanups or on our streets was coming from these sort of single-use items. And the very things that make plastic attractive to manufacturers, it's lightweight, it is fairly durable, doesn't break down easily. Those are the same factors that make it so problematic. That lightweight nature means that it's carried by the wind very easily, that even if you aim for the trash can and you miss, chances are it's going to end up in the street, it's going to end up in a storm drain, and then be carried into our bay.
And so most of it's coming from the land then that's ending up in the bay.
In San Francisco, in the San Francisco Bay, most of the plastic we find by far is coming from land uses. When you go out into the Pacific, it's many more uses. It's not just single-use items. There's the manufacture of plastics, the nurdles, the microplastics, the things that are in the production process. But here in San Francisco, where we don't produce plastic items, it's very much human-centered carelessness that is causing our problem.
And what's the kind of pathway here for that land-based plastic to end up in the bay? I'm sure some of it just gets blown in, but do we have any sort of treatment plants, like that runoff that's coming off the streets and the gutters? Are they catching this plastic, some of it at least, before it goes to the bay?
San Francisco has a fairly unique stormwater and sewer system in that it's combined. So anything in most 90% of San Francisco, when it gets into a storm drain, ends up at our sewage treatment plant. And the problem with these items, these plastic items, is that they can clog screens and grates, and they can impede the flow of water. This becomes a real big problem after a storm, where our storm drains can get clogged by items that have flown off of the street or been swept into our storm drain system. In other parts of the bay where there is not a combined system, it's basically going straight from the storm drain, from the curb into the storm drain and straight out into an outfall into the bay. So it depends where you live, but there's no good path for plastic.
And there's no technology fix for a kind of filter on the storm drain to
There absolutely are filters. They're expensive and they need to be cleaned out because they get cleaned out by hand. So to me, it's a matter of how do you want to spend your precious resources? Do you want to pay people to clean out storm drains, or do we want to prevent the problem at the source?
So we definitely want to talk about some of those solutions in a second, but I want to talk about the effects on marine life. We talked a bit about how this problem has come about, but Rachel, can you describe some of the effects of all this plastic on marine life?
Sure, yeah. I'm sure many of us have seen the images online of turtles with the straw up the nose, just animals becoming entangled, because plastic litter is harming and many times fatally harming marine life. You've got the ingestion route, which has been documented in animals ranging from seabirds to turtles to whales, where they consume plastic, whether they think it's a food source or it was just small enough that they didn't even realize it was part of their meal. And this eventually causes animals to starve when their stomach's filled with plastic. They can also get entangled and actually strangle the animal, cutting off air supply or making it just difficult to eat and swim and survive. And again, I'm sure people have seen these online. They're hard to watch. It's hard to see. But it's really important to understand that people are, the ones causing that plastic to be in the environment in the first place. And it's extremely dangerous. So, 34% of dead leatherback sea turtles have ingested plastic. We have those scientific stats to prove it, and it's just a matter of time of, enough is enough.
And Debbie, Rachel mentioned this video, and I'm curious your thoughts on how much the impact of these kinds of visuals kind of affect the political process when we're talking about implementing things like a plastic straw ban.
Yeah, those videos are so powerful. It's amazing. There's the saying, a picture is worth a thousand words. I would say the images that are spreading throughout social media are worth far more than a thousand words. They motivate us. They speak to us at such a deep level that we must take action. And I want to also add to what Rachel said about impacts on animals, because there's some impacts that we cannot see, but we're just understanding how important they are. And again, this gets back to the chemistry of plastic. Plastic has a quality that absorbs toxic chemicals to it. So as these plastic items break down into smaller and smaller particles, they tend to adhere and stick to toxic chemicals that might be floating around in our waters that are coming off of our roads from washing off pesticides or hydrocarbons from our cars. And they carry those toxic chemicals far away from our shores. And so when they become ingested, those small particles, by sea life, they can have profound impacts on the metabolism and the reproductive abilities of sea life. So we are impacting our sea creatures far beyond simple starvation. If that isn't bad enough, we're actually potentially impacting their ability to reproduce and survive.
So it's not just bad enough that they're eating the plastic, they're actually eating all these carcinogens with it. It's just compounding a nightmare problem. Well, Rachel, you described a bit about some of the research that's been done on the effects on marine life when they ingest these plastics, but do we have any strong sense of the extent of the harm that's occurring? I mean, there's multiple species affected. What's happening with those species, the number of species, and the extent of the harm to within those species? Do we have any sense of those numbers?
Yeah, so again, that's one of those things that I imagine it's much greater than what we've actually been able to scientifically prove. However, there has been reports for at least 663 marine wildlife species that have been negatively impacted by plastic. And, that's over half of them are entanglement and ingestion. But, as Debbie mentioned, it's important to keep in mind the newer science of the chemicals and all of those additional factors that may actually affect these species' survival long term, and may affect human health as well. So, yeah, it's tough to really say that anyone or anything can really get by in today's world without being negatively impacted to some extent by plastic.
And are there any specific species that are more impacted than others, or that are now at risk? Endangered species or threatened species because of this specific pollution problem?
Yeah, well, I think the two that really sort of stick out, obviously the turtles, they really mistake those plastic bags as jellyfish. So it's not that they're just accidentally eating plastic. They're purposely eating it, thinking that it is a food source. And same goes with a lot of the seabirds. So about 80% of seabird species that spend most of their time at sea have plastic in their stomachs. And this has become even a larger problem when you think about the way that birds feed their chicks, and they're actually regurgitating this plastic, feeding their chicks, thinking that they're doing something good, but they're actually, killing their young right from the start.
Those images are really heartbreaking to see. I definitely agree with both of you on that. And I wanted to go back to microplastics, because you mentioned that as a sort of subset issue. And can you just explain a bit more, Rachel, start with you on this, just sort of the global problem is on this, how microplastics come about and how they might behave differently from the typical plastic pollution that we might have from these visuals?
Yeah, so once plastic enters the ocean, it breaks down into those tiny fragments, as I mentioned, from wave, from wind, from sun, and, plastic does not biodegrade in our lifetime. So it does continue to break down into these smaller and smaller particles that will persist in the ocean, absorb toxins, as Debbie mentioned, and enter the food chain through fish and seabirds and other marine life. And, there's been some studies that have shown that it may even be replacing plankton as sort of the base of our food chain. So, microplastics is an emerging science. It's very new. Most scientists really don't like to say anything specific one way or another about it. But it is good to keep in mind that this is, almost like an unseen, invisible side effect to all those macroplastics that we're all used to seeing. And, the images of entanglement, it's those microplastics that may end up being that silent killer that we do need to keep an eye out for.
And Rachel, can we ever think of removing these? Is there any solution where we can get these things out of the water?
I've been looking and I have not found anything promising for microplastics. No, I mean, I've had scientists tell me it's not even really worth the research because we're not going to be able to filter our way out of this problem, just like we can't clean our way out of the problem. It comes down to, as Debbie mentioned, stopping it from the source. We really need to be rethinking, you know, how we tackle this plastic pollution problem. And once we've turned off the tap of plastic, then we can delve more research into figuring out how can we truly get this out of our system and out of our environment.
All right, so this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco. We're also streaming live on the web at KALW.org. And tonight we're talking about the enormous amount of plastic pollution in our oceans and what effects it has on marine life. And pretty soon we're going to talk about human health as well and those impacts of plastic pollution there and what we can do about it as land-based creatures, most of us are. So we want to hear from you. Bring us your questions or comments. Have you heard of creative ways that people are taking action to address this problem? What are some of the ways people can break free from dependence on single-use plastic? We'd love to hear your questions and comments. The number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on our website, kalw.org, or you can follow us and send questions to us via Twitter at CityVisionsKALW. Well, we have an email question in from Rick who asks, do compostable bags fully break down or are they a problem as well? Debbie Raphael,
that question
thoughts?
Puts a big smile on my face. And unfortunately, like so much in this world, the answer ultimately is it depends where they end up. So for the city of San Francisco, in our composting system, the compostable bags are built into the system in the sense that when you have your food scraps, you put them in a compostable bag, you put them in your green bin, Recology picks them up, they go to the compost facility. The facility is designed to have a high enough temperature and a long enough time period so that those compostable bags break down. Some composting programs are not designed that way and, in fact, do not want compostable bags in their systems. They don't want compostable forks. They don't want compostable cups. So it's very important to be intellectually honest when we're feeling good about ourselves for using anything single use just because it's compostable. It's not always true that your composting program can handle it. So it's very important to find out wherever you live from your garbage company, can you handle, are those items truly compostable in that system?
And so here in San Francisco and maybe the larger Bay Area, people should feel pretty assured? No,
here in San Francisco, you can feel good about it because our composting system is set up. But across the Bay, for example, in Marin County, they do not want compostable forks, compostable cups, or compostable bags in their green bins. So even though all the stores are using them and distributing them, the bottom line is it's still single use. And it's a problem.
So do we need reform so that these composting systems can accept these compostable forks and bags, things like that?
Ultimately, I believe that's true. We need robust composting programs across California for so many reasons. So the compostable plastics is a small piece of it. There's many reasons for the climate and the health of our soils that we need to up our composting. And we need to make sure that plastic does not get into our composting.
All right. So for our Marin County listeners, you have your marching orders now. Either don't use it or go advocate for a composting program that can break those down. And Debbie, staying with you, I wanted to ask you, we're talking before the break there about microplastics. Mm-hmm. How is this issue affecting the Bay and specifically the city of San Francisco, or is it affecting San Francisco?
Well, I think you asked a really interesting question. Is there anything we can do about it? And Rachel's absolutely right that once it gets into the water, it's pretty much hopeless. And the answer has to be upstream. What we're discovering in this new sort of era of understanding about microscopic impacts is that even some of our clothing contributes to the problem. So on the one hand, we're very proud that some of our clothing is made from recycled PET, you know, containers. But all those fibers, there is no away. So when you wash your clothes, and many of them are from synthetic compounds, those synthetic molecules, those microplastics, get released in your washing machine and go straight through into the sewage treatment plant where they are not treated. They go straight out into the bay. So we're interested in San Francisco is looking at installing special filters in washing machines so that they can capture the microplastics. This is new. This is something that we're interested in, but it's that idea of how do we prevent microplastics from entering into the water in the first place. And now let's look at all the sources, and our washing machines are one of them.
So this would be a San Francisco City ordinance on washing machine manufacturers.
Or I actually think it would be much more effective if it was statewide. Not why only San Francisco?
And as California goes, so goes the rest of the nation, given the size of our market.
Yeah, right? So that's my call to action. Let's talk to our legislators about that.
Well, I guess you have a path forward, because here in San Francisco, you can do something that might push the state to do something which then pushes the country.
And we have lots of examples of that.
All right, so people listening from San Francisco should feel proud. To the extent you agree with cleaning up our oceans, but I'd be hard-pressed to find someone who doesn't agree with that. Although, if you don't agree, we definitely want to hear from you, so do call in. If you don't believe this is a problem, we'd love to hear some counter-arguments here. But I wanted to ask about the effects on human health, and you know, the microplastic conversation kind of tees that up, because this is going to enter our food and water supply in some way. I mean, that's what some of the data is showing. So I wanted to ask, and maybe I'll start, Rachel, with you, how these microplastics are getting into our food and water supply, and what kind of dangers this is posing to human health?
Yeah, so as I've mentioned before, with microplastics, it's a really new science. And, you know, I think the answer to that question is a little bit that we don't quite know. We do know that plastic is in the food that we eat. It's in from seafood to salt. It's in the beverages we drink, from water to beer. And it's even in the air we breathe. But how it is affecting humans, we do not know. You know, I think another piece that we can, and bringing it back to sort of the bigger picture of plastic, is that we also know that toxic chemicals can migrate from many types of food packaging directly into the food that we eat. And this was actually a topic of discussion at a recent Unwrapped conference that took place. It brought scientists and public health leaders, advocates from all around the world, to discuss exactly this. What do we know and what do we need to know? And honestly, from my perspective, if we know it's in our food and water and we are getting these toxic chemicals from the packaging, that's enough. I don't need to know to what extent, what exactly it's causing. I mean, we know it can have, those types of chemicals can have a slew of effects, from cancer to lower IQ. You know, at this point, it's really, we know enough to stop it.
And Debbie, in terms of what you're seeing from the Department of San Francisco, I know you work for the state prior to this role. What are you seeing in terms of the public health impacts of all this plastic pollution?
So I find when we talk about impacts where we don't necessarily have yet that proof of cause and effect, we know that there are toxic chemicals in the plastic containers that we use. We know those chemicals leach out. We know that humans have evidence of those toxic chemicals in their bodies, but we can't necessarily put cause and effect together. That sometimes that can lead us to saying, well, we just need to study this more. We need more study. And the way I think about it is that it's important to ask the right question. So the question we often ask is it legal to have toxic chemicals inside plastic packaging? And the answer is yes, because our federal laws are not protective enough to keep us safe. So then we ask, well, is it safe? Is it harmful? Which is really the question you're asking. Is it safe to be exposed to that level of chemical? And the problem with that question is it depends who you ask. If you ask the manufacturer, they'll say, well, of course it's safe because it's the dose that makes the poison and you get such a little amount, don't worry about it. And then if you ask other public health officials, they'll say, well, no, very small amounts can be very harmful. So the only answer to the question, is it safe, what is the problem, is more study. And the problem with that answer, more study, is we don't do anything. It's the paralysis of analysis. So instead, the question we all should be asking is not, is it legal or is it safe, But is it necessary? Is it necessary for us to continue to use single-use plastics? Is it necessary for us to drink our water out of a plastic water bottle? Is it necessary for us to have a food container that's lined with plastic that carries BPA and endocrine-disrupting chemicals that leach out? Because we can answer that question today. We know there are safer alternatives, and we can take action by demanding that we have those safer alternatives.
And that makes sense to me, but isn't that a tough argument to say to someone whose livelihood might depend on this product or, you know, their economic bottom line is somewhat determined by this?
I would say the opposite. I would say that this is the way you stimulate innovation and you stimulate markets, because we send those signals as consumers every day by what we choose. And if we are choosing alternatives, that's a capitalistic system. That is how supply and demand works. And we're inviting all the manufacturers of the old system to step up and make the new. They know how to do it. They just need to know there's a demand.
All right. Well, this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and streaming live on the web at KALW.org. Tonight, we're talking about the enormous amount of plastic in our oceans and what effects it has on marine life and human health and what we can all do about it. We're joined by Debbie Raphael, director of San Francisco's Department of the Environment, and by Rachel Kosha, plastic pollution manager for the Surfrider Foundation. Our phone lines are open, and we'd love to hear from you and your questions or comments. What do you think of San Francisco's proactive approach on this issue? The number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment on our website, kalw.org, or you can follow us and tweet at us on Twitter at cityvisionskalw. Well, we have an email in from Clark who asks, do reusable plastic containers create microplastic contamination when they are washed? So, Rachel, let me direct Clark's question to you.
You know, I would lean towards avoiding plastic reusables, you know, for the microplastic, but more so for what we were just discussing, and that's the chemicals. So, you know, reusing a plastic container will eventually allow those toxic chemicals to leach out into the water and the food that you're consuming. And, you know, to make this even a little more complicated, you know, so BPA was a big thing, getting BPA out of our water bottles. There's signs now, you go into the stores, BPA free. However, that BPA chemical is typically replaced with a very similar chemical, such as BPS, which has been found to cause its own range of serious health problems. So, you know, if you try to avoid a specific chemical, you're going to run into the issue of these regrettable alternatives that end up getting replaced. So to be safe, stick with stainless steel, stick with glass. These are things that we know have a very low percentage of, you know, leaching any sort of unhealthy or toxic chemical into your system. And, you know, it's the way that we used to do things, and it's time we just go back to that mindset of using those glass packaging, buying things in bulk, and, you know, just getting a full system overhaul.
All right. So that's pretty good advice, sir, I think, for folks. Stay away from plastics altogether. Otherwise, we're just playing whack-a-mole on the chemicals. So thank you, Clark, for that question.
Exactly.
So we've got also an email in from Susan who says, we need to charge a lot for single-use bags, all of them, to encourage reusable ones, even give reusable ones away. And she says low-income people can still begin using them rather than paying for single-use. So, Debbie, San Francisco has pioneered the single-use plastic bag ban. As we mentioned, the opener back in 2007. What is your response to Susan's recommendation here?
Well, Susan, you are prescient because I just got out of a Board of Supervisors hearing a couple hours ago where we were discussing exactly this. Supervisor Valley Brown has put in proposed legislation to increase the charge on checkout bags. Right now it's 10 cents per bag, and our feeling is it's not quite enough to motivate behavior change. We're still seeing about 60% of people bringing their own bags, 40% don't. we know we can do better than that. We know other cities have done better than that when they've upped the charge. So the proposal is to up that charge to 25 cents. And of course, to your point, Susan, we need to make sure that those who can least afford it have access to reusable bags. I would add that the other piece that Supervisor Valley Brown's legislation will do is look at what we're calling pre-checkout bags. So those are the bags that are that you use to put your produce in. And what the legislation proposes is to actually ban the distribution of plastic pre-checkout bags. So all pre-checkout bags in San Francisco, if this legislation passes, would have to be compostable or they would have to be paper. So these, we're hoping that if they are compostable plastic, people will take those home and use them for their food scraps in our composting program, and that paper bags, if you must have a pre-checkout bag, paper's the way to go. It's easily recyclable. It's easily compostable. And of course, the best answer is to bring your own.
Mm-hmm. And what is the city doing with the revenue from these plastic ban charges?
So the way this works is that revenue stays with the business. So the 25-cent charge that is would be on a bag stays with the business. And this is for a couple reasons. This is to offset the cost if they are giving out a bag for a more expensive compostable or paper bag. It's also to stimulate compliance with the business so that they will join us in this mission to reduce the amount of bags by actually charging customers for them. They get to keep the money. And with that funds, we want them to educate as well. Educate their customers.
And have these fees been effective at reducing plastic pollution? Have you seen any data yet so far?
You know, I would be curious what Rachel says about that. We have actually seen much fewer of these single-use, the thin plastic bags flying around our city streets. They're almost non-existent now. I'm curious in the beach cleanups what Rachel would say.
Yeah, Rachel, what is Surfrider finding on these? We're seeing more of these bans proliferating now. California banned it statewide after San Francisco took the lead. What's your organization finding?
So we actually, CalRecycle released a report highlighting the results of a survey where they took thousands of stores and grocers. Within the first 6 months of the statewide ban, 86% of transactions that customers actually brought in their own bag and didn't purchase a paper or reusable bag. So as a result, there was an 85% reduction in the number of plastic bags and a 61% reduction in the number of paper bags provided to customers. And, you know, Surfrider has always advocated for bag laws that place a fee. So as Debbie was mentioning that, and as that question that came in from Susan, the fee is so crucial, you know, to really encourage people to bring their own bags, to continue reusing those cotton bags to the full extent of their life. And, you know, we don't want to just turn to paper either as the go-to from away from plastic because, you know, as we think about climate change and some of the other large issues that we're dealing with here on planet Earth these days, you know, switching away from plastic, we want to make sure doesn't harm any of those other issues like climate change and, you know, overuse of paper or anything like that. So this fee system has really been quite successful and, you know, the fee is key.
All right. Well, so it's good to know this policy is working. And we've got a special guest on the phone here. Now, Mary Crowley is the one who sailed out to the Great Pacific Garbage Patch and picked up 40 tons of drift nets. We're very happy that, Mary, you have been able to call in. We'd love to hear your story. So welcome to City Visions and tell us a little bit about your adventure out in the Great Pacific Garbage Patch.
I will, but I must say I've been listening a little and I've been a great fan of all the things that San Francisco does. San Francisco is a great example. I lecture around the world and I talk about all the good that has been happening and Surfrider certainly is a wonderful, wonderful organization that does lots of very significant work. So I have been focused on the issue of plastics polluting our ocean environment for the last 10 years. And I am definitely about stopping single-use plastics, getting plastics, you know, I love the concept of plastic-free grocery stores. I love all the innovation that can happen to rid us of this terrible menace. Mm-hmm. So I also am very much a believer that the professional maritime industry has the ability to significantly clean up and remove some of these awful areas of plastic garbage. And so we've worked on a variety of projects in the last 10 years, but the last year we began giving GPS satellite trackers to ships that were sailing across the North Pacific Subtropical Convergence Zone, or as many people call it, the garbage patch, though I hate that terminology because it's not a patch, it's a huge expanse of our precious ocean. But we gave these satellite trackers, and so when they came upon ghost nets or other large debris, they were able to tag them, and that allowed us to follow the distribution of the debris. And when we sent out our cleanup ship, which left Hawaii May 25th and went out for 25 days, the ship was able to go right to where the nets were. And I've done 2-month-long expeditions out to the gyre area with scientists and with engineers and trying to figure out the most efficient ways to clean up. And the one fascinating thing, which I had read about, but it's something else seeing it, is it's, of course, quite horrifying to see all of this garbage that is our garbage floating out in the beautiful, what should be pristine ocean. But the ocean amazingly sorts things. So you'll be sailing along and you'll start seeing all these big white laundry detergent bottles. And they won't be clumped together like an island, but, you know, over 5 miles, you would see several thousand of them. And it's not that they were all dumped together. It's the ocean kind of brings them together. Or you'll see a whole area filled with packing straps or a whole area filled with buckets. So, I mean, it's kind of fascinating, and we found that where we would find one ghost net, the derelict fishing gear, we would usually find more. And so we actually ended up bringing, we've been saying over 40 tons, it was actually 42 tons in, and that came from 7 of our trackers. So, you know, there was one situation where we had a net tagged, and the net was a relatively medium-sized one, maybe about 600 pounds. And within 5 miles of that, they found a 5-ton net, which, of course, was a conglomeration of 15 other nets. One net rolls over and catches ocean life, they catch other nets, they catch plastics, and these nets are killing machines for ocean life and for reefs, because when they go out of the exact gyre area and against a coral reef, they will smother it.
Wow. Well, Mary, you're really painting quite a picture of what this is like, you know, I would say on the ground, but out in the water. And it's we're very pleased you're able to call in to describe this. And I appreciate the good work that you're doing out there. So please do keep that up. And thank you so much for joining us.
I will. If people would like to see some videos or things, Ocean Voyages Institute.org. we have both, of course, our website and a Facebook page, and it's amazing to see what we pulled out.
Great.
So
no, thank you. Yeah,
thank you.
Well, it's our pleasure, and thank you for leaving that link. I was hoping there'd be a resource for those interested in more information. So this is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and streaming live on the web at KALW.org. Tonight we're talking about the enormous amount of plastic in our oceans and what effects this has both on marine life and on human health and what we can do about it. We're joined by Debbie Raphael, Director of San Francisco's Department of the Environment, and Rachel Kosha, Plastic Pollution Manager for the Surfrider Foundation. We want to hear from you with your questions or comments. The number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. And you can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org. You can post a comment on our website, kalw.org, or on Twitter, at City Visions, KALW, where we have a caller, Catherine, on the line. So, Catherine, thank you for calling in. You're calling in from Oakland, it looks like. So,
yes.
Welcome to City Visions.
Yes, a quick couple comments. One is I believe that we need better education of people who don't get it yet. I think most of the overeducated folks I know in the East Bay already have got it, though they're down with any policies or, you know, practices that are recommended. But I do think we need to reach out to a wider audience. I want to suggest plogging, which is a kind of event that combines recreation with picking up trash with a plogging stick. If you want to look it up, it's P-L-O-G-G-I-N-G. And one last thought was maybe hiring homeless people to pick up trash with these plogging equipment and equipping our citizenry with them for, say, Earth Day, to pick up trash while exercising. It's called plogging.
All right. Well, that's a new term, at least for me. But thank you, Catherine, for some of these ideas. And Debbie, what do you – I mean, plogging may not be something the city of San Francisco organizes, but I'm sure there are – you know, you've done some thinking about how to engage the citizens in these efforts to clean up. And, I mean, they obviously can reduce plastic on their own. But what about actually getting out there and cleaning things up? Are there things that the city is doing or other cities that are notable?
Well, I would say that – well, I also first have to say that I'm going to look up plogging because I don't know about plogging. So thank you for that. I learned something new just now. And in terms of our outreach, we think about it in two ways. How do we clean up the mess that's already there? And I would say that Surfrider has been amazing as with the Coastal Commission and the Coastal Cleanup Days and all the times that we bring in volunteers and work with our partners to pick up what's been discarded. What we're focusing on right now is what we're calling the refuse campaign. So that refuse, reuse. How do we get people, and it's not just the converted, but everyone, to think about refusing that single-use item and bringing their own cup, bringing their own bag, bringing their own utensils, reusable utensils, bringing their own a reusable straw. That's sort of that culture of convenience that we're trying to tackle right now. And we're doing that through social media. We're doing that with the schools working very with young children. We find that children are our biggest allies on this. They go home and educate their parents. So we have a very robust school education program. And it's never ending because as soon as we put our newest and best foot forward on public education, there is the market forces bringing that next item that they're saying you can't live without. That is some single use, highly convenient thing, such as food delivery services and all the micro packaging that goes into everything that comes to your door so simply. So this is unfortunately a never ending endeavor. And I totally agree with the caller that it's incumbent on all of us to make sure that we educate broadly on this subject.
All right. So lots of opportunities for engagement, both public and private sector there. Thank you, Catherine, for that call and for letting us know about plogging. And I want to go back to the phone lines to Karen in San Francisco. Karen, welcome to City Visions.
Hi. I was wondering if there's anything that isn't more toxic that could be done that could be put in the plastics to make them repulsive to animals. that just, you know, they wouldn't eat them at least. And it probably would make the problem worse. But if we can think of something to do or change the color or anything that we can do to make them, you know, less attractive.
Well, that's an intriguing question. So, Rachel, is this something Surfrider has looked into? Is there anything we can do to the plastic to at least make it less appealing, as Karen suggested, or less toxic?
Well, yeah, so that's not something we've looked into. You know, I will say that when we talk about, you know, even biodegradable plastics, that is another emerging area where it's not necessarily making the plastic more toxic or distasteful, but it's making it, you know, there's these new science emerging where it's trying to figure out, is there a way to make plastics so that it is able to be consumed and not harm wildlife? However, you know, with any of this, I will caution away from that single-use mentality. I think, you know, we're at a crucial moment right now in the history of our planet and, you know, it's the health of the environment that we do need to turn away from those easy solutions, those Band-Aids to the problem, you know, because even if we make it so that the animals don't want to eat it, it's still going to continue to accumulate and accumulate, and we don't want to lose our precious, pristine, you know, ocean and islands and waterways. And, you know, it doesn't stop the problem from getting into us either. So, you know, there's definitely two different mindsets, I think, as Debbie was saying, that you can think about this. And it's the, you know, how do we clean it up? How do we put the Band-Aid on the problem? Or do we get down to it and we say, how do we refuse these items? How do we, you know, break our dependence and move forward in a future that is less plastic.
All right. Well, thank you, Karen, for that question. Might have been on the minds of others as well, so it's good we can address it. We have a pretty practical question here, emailed in from Rebecca, who says she has been pretty successful at eliminating single-use plastic, except for the issue of storing vegetables in her refrigerator, and what do our speakers here recommend? So, Debbie, Raphael, how do we store our vegetables in the fridge?
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. We tend to think that plastics are helpful to our vegetables, because they keep the moisture in. The challenge with that moisture is it can lead to essentially a degradation of the vegetable itself. And those crisper drawers are meant to move air around. So when you actually encase your vegetables in your crisper in plastic, you're a bit defeating the purpose of the crisper drawer. So what we would recommend is there are these reusable produce bags that breathe a little bit. And those are actually better for keeping your vegetables fresh and in the crisper. So I would recommend trying those out.
Wow. And now, how do we buy berries then without plastic? Because they come with plastic.
Well, now that's a different question. So if you're saying, I mean, there's a choice that you make when you go to the produce market, and do you put something in plastic and then store it? And then there's the how you get it. If it comes in a plastic container, like the berry containers, that's very challenging. And the way to solve that is, if you can, to buy bulk and to go to a farmer's market or a store that allows you to shop in bulk. And then I would either put the berries in a reusable container or in a paper bag, because the paper is breathing a bit more.
All right, some excellent, very practical tips here. So another question emailed in from David, who specifically wants to know from Debbie what San Francisco is doing about cigarette butt plastic pollution. They're all over the sidewalks and streets. They're also toxic. So what's happening there?
Cigarette butts, man, the bane of my existence, and I'm sure Rachel feels the same way. So in San Francisco, we were the first city, and as far as I know, the only city to do this, though I'm not 100% sure of that. We put a fee on every pack of cigarettes sold in San Francisco, and that fee becomes a pot of money that then goes to our public works department to help them fund the cleanup of cigarette butts. We are doing some pilot programs of containers that are being sort of disposal containers that can be put in neighborhoods with the help of volunteers, with the help of our public works department. And, you know, I would love it if we could magically have smokers keep their butts to themselves, so to speak. But there is a big need for education on this.
So maybe kind of an ironic benefit of more of these vape pens, a Juul.
I'm not going to go there.
Separate issue. We can discuss that on a future City Visions. Don't have to address it. Now, I want to talk, we only have a few minutes left. I want to talk about some of the solutions here. San Francisco has been a pioneer. And maybe, Debbie, starting with this plastic straw ban, just to give us a little bit of the recent history here. This is brand new, just came into effect last week. Was that tough to put into effect? I mean, how was that political process, and what are some of the next frontiers? And maybe what can we learn from the plastic bag ban and now this plastic straw ban?
Yeah.
Where are things going in San Francisco politically on this?
Well, I like to say that San Francisco considers itself a member state of the EU. And what that means is we look to Brussels more than we do to Washington for our inspiration on policies. And if you look at the European Union right now and other countries around the world, there is a big focus on eliminating single-use plastics. So our straw ban, it was a plastic straw ban, not a straw ban. You can still get straws in San Francisco. They're just paper if you really need them. And they're on request, so they're not automatically given to you. And straws were not that difficult to, or plastic straws were not so difficult to ban. There was a concern about the alternatives and was it available and were the small businesses going to be hurt? And so what we did was and this I think is something that is a lesson learned from these programs, is you don't have the ordinance go into effect immediately. You allow the market to adjust. So there was a year between the date that the ordinance was passed and that it went into effect. So it went into effect July 1st, just a week or so ago. And during that time, again, just like I said earlier in the show, the market stepped up with the alternatives and the paper straws became much better and more effective, more long-lasting, and cheaper. So we allowed the market to respond to the signals we gave it. In the same aspect of banning other single-use plastic items like stirrers and lid plugs and toothpicks, we are allowing the market to give us alternatives so that if they are necessary, people can access them. When we look at the future, we're looking at the tools that we have in place, like charges, like the charge on checkout bags, like banning plastic single-use pre-checkout bags. We're looking at other signals to the consumers to refuse. And consumers respond to things like charges. They respond to bans. And so we want to send a larger signal to rethink the way you connect with plastic in your life. And we do that with these single items, but not because they solve the problem, but because they shed light on it.
And Rachel, final thoughts to you. What is Surfrider looking to do next, sort of policy-wise? What would be on your top wish list to address this problem?
Yeah, well, policy-wise, you know, it's reaching more of those comprehensive bans. So looking at all of those top polluted items and really doing sweeping bans of them, you know, but there's also a couple different ways you can approach it through the education for action, through the beach cleanups that, you know, get the data collection to help fuel those political campaigns. And then we have an ocean-friendly restaurants program where we get businesses and restaurants in the community to be those leaders that are showing and paving the way for other businesses and for their customers to see that it's easy to go plastic-free. It saves money. It's a healthier lifestyle. And you know, if we all work together, we can make using single-use plastic as strange as smoking on an airplane. Just a culture shift.
And Rachel, I'm glad you mentioned businesses. Is there anything happening in the business community that's a particular note that consumers should be supporting on this issue?
Well, you know, I would say just within our Ocean Friendly Restaurants program, you can certainly support them. We have 460 restaurants currently growing every day in the program, and that's across the country in at least 16 states. So you can definitely go to the Surfrider website, look up ocean-friendly restaurants in your community, and go support them. Show that you care about this as well and that you support their decision to voluntarily go plastic-free and make you know, really great adjustments in their business to help support this great movement.
And Debbie, real quick, we just got a question about hemp packaging. Any quick thoughts on that, or Rachel? Or I'll start with you, Debbie.
No, I have no quick thoughts, except that hemp is an organic material, but I have no quick thoughts.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately. That's City Visions for this evening. Our guests were Debbie Raphael, Director of San Francisco's Department of the Environment. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for this opportunity.
And also want to thank Rachel Kosha, Plastic Pollution Manager for the Surfrider Foundation. Thank you, Rachel.
Yeah, thanks. This has been great.
And thanks for joining us. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on KALW.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. And tonight's show, this is her final show with us after 4 years with the program. We're very sad about that, but looking forward to the bigger and better things she'll be moving on to. Our producer was Ann Harper. So thank you so much, Ann, for all of your work for the show over the last 4 years. And join us next time on City Visions with my co-host Joseph Pache sits down with New York Times bestselling author and Oakland native Tommy Orange to talk about his acclaimed debut novel, There, There. This is Ethan Elkind. Thanks so much for listening. Good night and have a great rest of your week.